If you would allow me, I'd like to take you back in time, back to September of 2009, as a new American leader was making his first appearance at the annual United Nations General Assembly. President Barack Obama was just 8 months into his first term, and the big UN meeting was kind of his big debut on the global diplomatic stage. He and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, were greeted warmly by American allies as they announced a more cooperative approach to international affairs as opposed to the with us or against us attitude of the prior administration. But President Obama was not the only world leader attending his very first UN General Assembly that day. Another first-timer got almost as much attention as Obama, but unlike the new American president, this guy had been ruling his country for 40 infamous years.
His Excellency Muammar Gaddafi, leader of the revolution, president of the African Union, king of kings of the traditional kings of Africa.
Gaddafi raged on for 95 minutes and 8 seconds, a diatribe against the UN from a jumble of handwritten notes, waving a copy of the UN Charter, then pretending to rip it up.
It should not be called the Security Council. It should be called the Terror Council.
He made no mention of the Libyan bombing of Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie, but launched a bizarre harangue about the assassination of President Kennedy.
We want to know who killed him. Somebody by the name of Lee Harvey, and then another, Jack Ruby, killed Lee Harvey. Why did he kill him?
Mystifying the UN and the White House.
If I were to try to begin to explain the actions of Mr. Gaddafi today, I might be busy the better part of the remainder of the afternoon.
The speech from the Libyan dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, was weird. Really weird. He called for the UN headquarters to be relocated to Libya so that he could avoid jet lag. But remarkably, this was not even the weirdest part of Gaddafi's visit to the United States. The weirdest part was Gaddafi's repeated attempts to find somewhere to pitch his tent. Literally. Gaddafi liked to travel with a traditional Bedouin tent, which he would set up wherever he was going. And we're not talking about a small camping tent here. This was a big structure where he could hang out with his entourage and host dignitaries. Of course, it also had to have room for his all-female security detail, which traveled with him everywhere he went. But when he came to New York in 2009 for this UN meeting, nobody was interested in letting him camp out on their property. First, he tried to get a permit to pitch his tent in Central Park. New York officials nixed that idea. Then he tried a spot across the river in New Jersey, but for some reason, no one there wanted a dictator and admitted terrorist camping next door. So it was beginning to look like Gaddafi was out of luck for his tent. But ultimately, he found one New Yorker who was happy to host him. One New Yorker who looked at Muammar Gaddafi and saw not an international pariah, but a business opportunity. And I'm going to give you one guess as to which New Yorker I'm talking about.
The wealthy suburb of Bedford, New York, north of here, is the home of Richard Gere, Martha Stewart, and perhaps by tomorrow, Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. Donald Trump's organization says it's looking into published reports that Gaddafi has literally put down stakes at Trump's estate in Bedford, New York, for this week's UN visit, and that he's trying to pitch his tent, including the requisite satellite dishes, on the estate, which is known as Seven Springs. Late today, a local newspaper in Bedford reported the town has issued a stop work order because nobody had gotten a permit for the Gaddafi tent.
I love that the Trump organization said it was looking into reports that Gaddafi had pitched his tent on Trump's property, as if he had just randomly shown up on Trump's lawn and it was a total surprise to everyone. The town made them take the tent down, and Donald Trump made this big show of how he was shocked to find the Libyan dictator on his property. But of course, Trump himself had made the deal to let him stay there. And in true Donald Trump fashion, later on, he couldn't stop himself from bragging about how much money he made on the deal.
I'm the only one. I made a lot of money with Gaddafi. If you remember, he came to the country and he had to make a deal with me because he needed a place to stay and he paid me a fortune and never got to stay there.
Trump didn't make nearly as much money as he'd hoped to make, however. BuzzFeed News later reported that Trump had made the deal to let Gaddafi stay at his property because why else? He wanted to get the Libyan dictator to invest some of his oil billions in Trump properties. Long before he was president, Donald Trump had an affinity for foreign dictators. But once he became president, he got the opportunity to meet so many more of them. Vladimir Putin, of course, whom Trump had been dying to meet for years. Trump also traveled to the Philippines to meet their terrifying autocrat, best known for telling his police to shoot drug suspects on sight, resulting in thousands of deaths. In a speech in Washington just last month, Trump pointed to the Philippines' bloody, lawless drug war as a model for the United States. But maybe Trump's favorite autocrat was this man, Viktor Orban of Hungary, because here was a guy who was demonstrating in real time how to use the power of the state to undermine democracy and cement his hold on power. Over his 12 years as prime minister, Viktor Orban has attacked Hungary's independent judiciary, taken over most of the country's media, criminalized civil society groups, prevented his political opposition from campaigning, and enacted emergency powers that let him rule by decree. By the time he ran for re-election for the third time a couple of months ago, his victory was a foregone conclusion. He has based his movement on an appeal to an explicitly white Christian heritage for Hungary. Just last week, Orban delivered a speech in which he condemned, quote, race mixing, saying that European people should not mix with non-Europeans, and he doesn't want Hungary to become mixed race. Even one of his longest-serving advisors could not stomach that speech. She resigned, calling it, quote, a pure Nazi speech. And after all that, as Viktor Orban headed to the United States for a visit this week, can you guess what his very first stop was? A visit to Donald Trump's golf club. Because when you are an autocratic leader being shunned by everyone in the Western world, and you're fresh off a speech that even your close advisor calls pure Nazi, never fear. The fine properties of the Trump Organization are always open to you. And Donald Trump himself will be there to welcome you with open arms. Except this time, it's not just Donald Trump. Viktor Orban stopped off at Trump's club because he was on his way to Texas to address the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, the premier annual gathering of American conservatives, or at least that's what it used to be. The chair of the conference was asked whether they might reconsider hosting Orban in light of his no race mixing pure Nazi speech. CPAC's chair responded, quote, let's listen to the man speak. Let's see what he says. Apparently forgetting that everyone already did listen to Viktor Orban speak and did see what he said, which is the entire problem. And so today, the whole firmament of the American conservative movement welcomed Viktor Orban to their conference. And boy, did they love what they heard.
Ladies and gentlemen, we were the first ones in Europe who said no to illegal migration and stopped the invasion of illegal migrants. Hungarian state institutions are obliged to protect the Christian culture of Hungary. Hungary shall protect the institution of marriage as the union of one man and one woman. Family ties shall be based on marriage or the relationship between parents and children. To sum up, the mother is a woman, the father is a man, and leave our kids alone. Full stop, end of discussion. My government is devoted to law and order without compromise. We decided we don't need more genders, we need more rangers. Less drag queens and more Chuck Norris.
Boy, the autocratic prime minister of Hungary sure knows his audience. Christian heritage, no foreigners, more police, no gay marriage, no transgender rights, and apparently no drag queens. And while you're at it, less democracy. Because if you want a white Christian nationalist government and society, representative democracy and pluralism doesn't really mix well with that. Orban told the CPAC conference today that he and American conservatives should join forces, but that's already happening. Fox News' Tucker Carlson is Orban's biggest cheerleader here in the United States. He took his show to Hungary last year. Orban returned the favor, quoting Carlson in his speech today. CPAC itself held a conference in Hungary just a few months ago. This is the guy American conservatives are looking to for inspiration. And it's showing up not just in conservative conferences, but in election results. Lots of Donald Trump-supported election deniers won this week's Republican primaries. Candidates who pledged to mess with America's election infrastructure until they get the results they want. The Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania is a textbook Christian nationalist in the mold of Viktor Orban. The guy who won the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in Arizona a couple of days ago, almost entirely funded by a billionaire who says he no longer believes in democracy. Not too long ago, if a dictator visited the United States, nobody, other than Donald Trump, wanted anything to do with him. But the Republican Party is Trump's party now, and the right kind of dictator can come here and get a standing ovation. Joining me now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who attended the CPAC conference in Dallas today. David, good to see you. Sounded like a rowdy, fun conference in which the speakers, and he's just one of them, Viktor Orban, knew what the audience wanted and threw them that red meat.
Yeah, that's the point of the conference. This is what they like to think of as the Republican wing, the conservative wing of America's conservative party. It is really sort of defines at times the far right reaches of what's acceptable in Republican Party politics. Among the speakers will be Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Fox News' Sean Hannity on this very hour. And Jack Posobiec, a peddler of conspiracies, including the one that, was called Pizzagate, that led to people being shot up in a pizza parlor in a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. So, this is a place where a lot of heat is fostered around a lot of hot button issues. What was impressive in some ways, just from a technical standpoint, was how many hot button issues Viktor Orban, this prime minister of this small Central European country, could set off for his very conservative American audience.
What is it about him? What is it about the Hungarian leader that makes him such a favorite, in particular with Fox News and this CPAC crowd?
Well, I think that one thing is his success. He just won his fourth straight election to be prime minister of that country in elections that Freedom House, an independent operation that sort of monitors civil rights, civil liberties, and elections, called a free but not fair setup for elections. I think also the fact that he's able to explicitly invoke the notion of Europeans needing to both protect and project Christian values, but also the idea that, as he said last week, races should not mix. He's able to say things that certain elements of Republican and conservative thought nowadays touch upon, but don't want to say as explicitly. And there he is saying it out loud. I'm not saying that's true for all Republicans or all conservatives, but there's an element that is happy to hear it in an age where wokeism and cancel culture and BLM are these touchstones for Republicans on the right. And by the way, all of which he talked about in his speech earlier today. I also think that the fact that you saw him talk about migration in this country, borders are a rallying cry for the right. In a way that in some ways right now, abortion rights are a rallying cry for the left in this country and for much of the center as well. And that's something in which Orban was able to find certain kinds of electoral support for in his country, even as he was doing everything to do these Trump-like things of intimidate, to buy off, to grind down, or to smother independent voices in outside outfits like the press, like universities, like non-governmental outfits that monitor human rights.
And the idea of the immigration, the hard line on immigration is one place, as you mentioned, and you write in your piece, that Viktor Orban sort of overlaps with the American right. But there are issues in which Hungary and Orban diverge with the American right as well that you talk about.
Yeah, in doing reporting, talking to Hungarian journalists and others, you found that abortion is legal there. It's restricted some after, I believe, 12 or 15 weeks, but it's legal up to 24 weeks under certain conditions. They have universal health care paid for and arranged for by the government. In addition, gun ownership is strongly, severely regulated there. These are not stances that people at what's called CPAC, this event, would embrace in any way, shape, or form. However, that's not the point. The point is you have tonally somebody willing to stand up to what he calls the global ruling classes, lumping together people in the media and academia and independent outfits, as I said before, people like the liberal Hungarian-born Jewish philanthropist George Soros, who's a bogeyman for Orban, just as he is for so many on Fox and so many on the American right. You know, it's a tonal thing. He's willing to take them on unapologetically. One of the things he said today was, a Christian politician, a Christian political leader can never be racist because of his values, because of his Christian values. He said they will always keep us from going too far. It's a crazy defense in some ways of the eye of against the condemnation that he received for the kinds of statements that you touched on a bit earlier. That is, that the idea that races shouldn't mix in Hungary is not racist because he can't be racist because he has Christian values.
It's quite something. But as you mentioned, he keeps getting reelected. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We always appreciate having you on.
You
want to bring into the conversation Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor of history at New York University and the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. She is an expert on authoritarian leaders like Viktor Orban. And he and his people have actually gone after you a lot in the last several months because you and I have talked about it and you've spoken a lot about Viktor Orban and how out of step he is, in fact, with even his NATO neighbors in Europe. But he continues to gain popularity. I should point out, which I think you'll do anyway, he wins elections, but every election is a little bit less free than the last one.
Yes, that's right. And the reason he's the idol of the GOP is that he has shown the workings of what's called electoral autocracy. And he calls, talks about Hungary being in a liberal democracy, but there's nothing democratic about it at this point, where he's managed to have this, you know, capture the institutions, and his party has a huge amount of power, so that the elections are kind of rigged. And in fact, the last election, his opponent hadn't been invited on national TV since 2019. So there's the veneer of freedom, but the practice is despotic. And that's what the Republicans are very interested in.
But this is a point you have made that always stands out to me, that we have an association here with the idea that if the vote exists and there are elections, then there must be democracy and hence freedom. And you point out that increasingly in a world that is marching toward more authoritarianism, there's still votes. There's still elections. There's lots of countries in the world that have elections that are neither free nor fair.
That's right. And so actually the metric that you need to use for democracy versus, autocracy today is not really elections, but transparency and accountability. And that's in short supply in Hungary because, it's very difficult to be a critical voice when he has these international conferences and he allows some dissidents to be there, which is typical. But it's very difficult to have, as we saw in the last election, he just keeps winning over and over again. And now what he's doing is, trying to be the kind of mentor, the strong man who's going to have, lead the alliance of the far right international, because he's trying to go into the space that, Putin's a little too toxic now. Mm-hmm. People fall out of windows. He's got his war. And so Orban becomes the acceptable despot. Huh.
And you wrote today that, in fact, Orban's appearance at CPAC is the outcome, the words you used, of a carefully cultivated relationship. That's particularly important in this moment. Who's cultivating this relationship?
Well, he's got Hungary's a small country. And what better thing than to have Tucker Carlson give a whole week of his show over to you and make you a showpiece. And so it's like a very good synergy that they have going. And so, they're helping one another. They're giving each other legitimacy. And that's very important to Orban. And so, in fact, at the end, he said, we need to make new agreements with the Chinese, the Russians, and the Americans, but it might be easier, with the Republicans. Now, he didn't mention Trump, which is very typically autocratic because they're very opportunistic and transactional. He didn't mention Trump at all at CPAC. And he will make a deal with whoever he needs to keep that relationship going. It might be Trump, it might not.
Ruth, as always, thank you for your time tonight. Ruth Ben-Ghiad is a professor of history at the New York University. She's an expert on authoritarianism. We always appreciate your time. Well, up next, the issue that has Republicans panicked about the midterms. Stay with us.
If you take Tudor Dixon at her word when it comes to outlawing abortion, she's told us exactly who she is.
Are you for the exemptions for rape and incest?
I am not.
No exceptions for rape and incest, or what about health of the mother?
No exceptions.
Tudor Dixon. That's not acceptable from Michigan.
Blake Masters has made his dangerous ideas on abortion easy to understand.
I actually think we should go further.
The federal government needs to step in and say no state can permit abortion.
You make it illegal and you punish the doctors.
Blake Masters, too dangerous for Arizona.
Those are two new ads out today targeting Arizona Republican Senate candidate Blake Masters and Michigan Republican gubernatorial candidate Tudor Dixon. Those two Republican candidates only won their party nominations on Tuesday, but they're already facing ads like that, giving voters a sample of the candidates' extreme positions on abortions, on abortion in their own words. And that may have something to do with the other election that happened on Tuesday night when voters in the state of Kansas, a state that Donald Trump won by nearly 15 points in 2020, overwhelmingly rejected a Republican proposal that would have removed protections for abortion rights in that state. Republicans have spent the last 2 days struggling to explain the results of that Kansas election. Kansas Republican Senator Roger Marshall told Politico today it was quite a gut punch. Yes, I'm shocked. Absolutely shocked. That's not what I was expecting, not what I was told the polling showed, and I thought it was going to be a tight race. I don't have an explanation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was also at a loss for an explanation when he was asked about Kansas on Fox News.
I don't think we really know until the end of the year what kind of an impact putting this issue back into the hands of those of us who are elected, as opposed to nine unelected judges, will have on the country. We're in the process of finding that out.
Do you think Kansas tells you something about that?
It tells us that there were a lot of people interested in the issue in Kansas. There's no question about that.
It's a bit of a dodge. As Republican leaders struggle to deal with the electoral consequences of the Supreme Court's decision on Roe v. Wade, some Republican officials are moving full steam ahead toward an even more radical anti-abortion agenda. Today, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced his decision to suspend a county prosecutor in Tampa who had promised not to prosecute those who, quote, seek, provide, or support abortions, end quote. That prosecutor had just been reelected by voters in 2020, but Ron DeSantis decided to overrule those voters. With the midterm elections less than 100 days away, it's clear that the Supreme Court's decision to end Roe v. Wade still looms large. And Republicans aren't sure how to deal with it. So what do we expect in the coming months? Joining us now is Erin Carmon, senior correspondent at New York Magazine, who covers this very closely. Erin, good to see you again. Democrats wasting no time, as we just saw in those ads, trying to make their Republican opponents' records on abortion part of this election. Are those ads, like the ones we just played, are they going to have an impact on how people choose to vote?
Well, Ali, I mean, I think the most important thing is that the victory in Kansas belongs to the organizers on the ground who spoke to people, met people where they were, and turned people out. So, yes, abortion is broadly popular, even in a state like Kansas. They did not want to see a total ban. And in states like Arizona and Michigan, which are purple states, you look at the numbers there, people don't want to see these total bans either. And so I think it's a question of activating people. People are paying attention because the Supreme Court did the unthinkable. It allowed the words to be said, Roe v. Wade has been overturned. Now, John Roberts wanted the Supreme Court to take a more incremental step. I had to laugh hearing Mitch McConnell say that there were nine unelected justices as if they aren't implementing the policy agenda that he has declined to put, he declined to put on the floor when he controlled the Senate. He's been pretty happy with the nine unelected judges when they, for example, strike down campaign finance and voting rights, but okay. The Supreme Court has made this real. And I think that that's the biggest difference. people are used to seeing ads that tell them this or that is going to happen if this person gets elected. But what people in Kansas realize and what people across the country are going to realize is that because the Supreme Court ripped the rug out from under these constitutional protections, this is not a theoretical question. People in Missouri are being denied Plan B, rape survivors. Miscarriage care all over the country is being compromised. Republicans are defending 10-year-old rape victims being forced to carry to term. So we can no longer say, okay, if you elect this Republican, maybe somewhere down the road, you know, abortion will be chipped away at. It's a reality. It's a reality in states all around Kansas. It's a reality in states all around Michigan and in Arizona as well. And so knowing that this is what indeed is being fought in these very same states, I think that that is going to have voters paying closer attention if Democrats stay on this issue and if they turn people out.
Well, the New York Times did an analysis using the Kansas results to project how the rest of the country would have voted on similar referenda. And they found that voters would support abortion rights in all but seven states. I don't know if you've had a chance to dig into this, but what do you make of that analysis? And obviously, every state's a little bit different because Kansas was starting from a position in which it had abortion protections in its state constitution. Wisconsin doesn't have that. Michigan's trying to get it on as a ballot question. So everybody's in a little bit of a different position. But what do you make of this sort of analysis?
I think we've known for a long time that public opinion on abortion is broadly in favor of access. People do not want to see abortion banned. There have been ways in which Republicans have tried to turn it into wedge issues. And there are also, by the way, times in which anti-abortion activists have succeeded in their ballot initiatives in states like Alabama, West Virginia, Tennessee, but they did so really under the radar. It may be, you know, and one of them was Louisiana, which I believe was highlighted in that New York Times graph. But I think, again, those were low turnout elections, similar to the one that was expected in Kansas, isn't what happened. They were ones in which perhaps Democrats didn't mobilize people on abortion. So now with folks paying attention and with people being emboldened by what the folks in Kansas managed to pull off, I think that we're talking about a different story. We've always known that this is what the polling says. We haven't known, will people turn out? Will they actually pull the lever? And it remains to be seen, you know, when they're voting on a candidate, whether that will be different than voting just specifically on an issue to take something away that is the status quo as found by the Kansas report.
Right. There's a lot of elements to what happened in Kansas that are specific to Kansas, but it surprised a lot of people on both sides of the issue this week. Erin, good to see you again. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Erin Carmona is a senior correspondent at New York Magazine. I want to quickly bring you a major and sadly not unexpected update on a story that we've been following closely. Today, a Russian court sentenced the American citizen Brittany Griner to 9 years in prison after something of a show trial with a predetermined outcome. The basketball star has been detained in Russia since February, about a week before Russia invaded Ukraine, when vape cartridges containing cannabis oil were found in her luggage. Now Griner's hopes turn to international diplomacy. President Biden released a statement today condemning Russia's harsh sentence for Brittany Griner and reiterating his call for her release and that of another detainee, Paul Whelan. A U.S. official tells NBC News that Russia has not responded substantively to a, quote, serious offer that the U.S. made in June for a prisoner swap for the Russian arms trafficker Viktor Bout. But officials will keep pressing for her release. So this is a portrait of so-called justice in Russia. Here in America, there was another big update about justice for Breonna Taylor. We'll have more on that next.
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
Breonna Taylor!
Breonna Taylor!
Say her name!
Say her name.
Breonna Taylor.
Say her name.
Breonna Taylor.
I've waited 874 days for today.
It's here now.
Amen.
It's here now.
Right. Amen.
For 874 days, Tamika Palmer, activists and protesters across the country have been calling for justice for Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old emergency room technician whom police shot dead in her home during a nighttime raid in March of 2020. Louisville police officers executed a search warrant related to a drug investigation that Breonna Taylor had nothing to do with. They used a battering ram to enter her home around midnight. Police say they knocked and announced themselves. Breonna Taylor's boyfriend says all they heard was loud banging and got no answer when they asked who was at the door. Breonna Taylor's boyfriend feared it was a break-in, so he fired his gun once. That's when police blindly fired multiple rounds into the apartment, shooting Breonna Taylor. She did not receive immediate medical attention. She died that night. There were no drugs found in the apartment. So for 874 days, Breonna Taylor's family and people across this country have been asking law enforcement to hold the police who killed her accountable. And at one point, in September of 2020, just months after she was killed, it looked like maybe that day would come. A Kentucky grand jury had a chance to indict three officers involved in Breonna Taylor's death. They indicted one. The grand jury charged him with three counts of wanton endangerment for shooting into a neighbor's apartment, not for shooting Breonna Taylor, and he was later acquitted. Fast forward to today when the federal Justice Department weighed in.
Justice Department has charged four current and former Louisville Metro Police Department officers with federal crimes related to Ms. Taylor's death. Those alleged crimes include civil rights offenses, unlawful conspiracies, unconstitutional use of force, and obstruction offenses. Federal charges announced today allege that members of the place-based investigations unit falsified the affidavit used to obtain the search warrant of Ms. Taylor's home, that this act violated federal civil rights laws, and that those violations resulted in Ms. Taylor's death.
The four officers charged include three officers who were part of the investigative unit which obtained the search warrant to raid Breonna Taylor's home that night. The fourth is Brett Hankison, the officer who was fired from the police department for shooting blindly into Taylor's home. The Justice Department has been investigating the practices of the Louisville Police Department for a year now, and today the Department of Justice argues that three of the officers made false claims in the search warrant affidavit connecting Breonna Taylor to their drug investigation. The DOJ also argues that Hankison deprived Taylor, her boyfriend, and their neighbors of their constitutional rights when he fired recklessly into the apartment through a window covered with blinds. Now, if these officers are convicted of any of these charges, they could face years in prison. For example, willfully violating someone's rights when it results in death can result in a maximum sentence of life in prison. The indictment today did not name the officers who actually shot and killed Taylor, but at the very least, 874 days after Breonna Taylor was killed, these are the potential consequences these four officers now face. One of Breonna Taylor's family attorneys, Ben Crump, put it this way after the charges were announced.
As Dr. King said, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Yes, right. Well, today it bent towards Breonna Taylor. Yeah.
What I'm about to show you is the absolutely unbelievable email exchange in which the legal team for the far-right media personality Alex Jones accidentally sent the opposing legal team a 2.3 gigabyte digital copy of Alex Jones's cell phone contents. Texts, emails, everything. This is the opposing legal team's lawyer via email to Alex Jones's lawyer. Quote, I forwarded this email to my paralegal to download this production. He asked me to take a look because it was a huge amount of material he was downloading, and he wanted me to verify that he needed to download all of it. I looked through the directories, and they seemed to contain a lot of confidential information. My assumption is now that you did not intend to send us this. To which Alex Jones's lawyer replies, quote, thank you. There appears to have been a mistake in the file transfer. Please disregard the link. Now, unfortunately for Alex Jones, just saying please disregard the link does not hold a lot of weight legally, and Jones's lawyers apparently didn't do any of the lawyery things they needed to do to meaningfully restrict the cell phone contents that had been inadvertently forwarded to the other side. And now, not only does the opposing legal team in this case have the contents of Jones' cell phone, but the January 6th investigation has now requested the contents from them as well. And it looks like Jones's opposition's lawyers will be complying with that request.
I've been asked to turn them over today. I certainly intend to do that unless you tell me not to. I don't see how the protective order can be applied in a way that would prevent me from doing that. I think they've dropped the ball completely.
Turned it over to authorities. Turned it over to who are you turning it over to? Are you allowed to say?
I've been asked by the January 6th committee to turn their.
I don't know that you get to stop that anyway.
Well, if they subpoenaed them, it would be a very different story.
Well, they're going to now. They know about them. They know they exist. They know you have them. I think they're going there either way.
Now, what's most amazing to me about all of this is not just the oops, wrong attachment moment. What's most amazing to me is this case isn't about January 6th. It's about Sandy Hook. For nearly a decade, Alex Jones has been pushing a dangerous conspiracy theory that claims that the Sandy Hook massacre in 2012 was a hoax. I was on the scene hours after it happened in Newtown, Connecticut on December 14th, 2012, within hours of the massacre, long before many parents knew they had lost their kids, 26 people died. 20 of them were first graders. All of them were real, with real families who suffered first from that tragedy and then later from the psychological torment and literal harassment produced by the conspiracy theory that Alex Jones was pushing. Today, the jury in this case decided that Jones owes two of those Sandy Hook parents $4.1 million in damages for his actions. And that is all just from one trial for two parents. Jones has multiple more damages trials ahead of him for his role in pushing this Sandy Hook conspiracy theory, which should ultimately cost him a ton of money. But it's like a cosmic justice bonus that because of Jones's lawyer's mistake, this case could also be handling January 6th investigators evidence that could be used in that investigation. It's important to remember that the January 6th committee tried to speak with Mr. Jones back in January. He claims to have pleaded the Fifth Amendment nearly 100 times. And there's a lot Alex Jones could have said in that interview that maybe his texts can now say for him. Take, for example, the story we learned from White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson about President Trump's demanding that once he finished his speech on January 6th, he wanted to be taken to the Capitol to march with his supporters. How Trump allegedly physically fought with a Secret Service agent to try to get taken there. We didn't know that until the January 6th hearings last month, but check out this video of Alex Jones at the Capitol on January 6th after Trump ended his speech, telling his supporters to march on the Capitol.
Oh, yeah, Alex Jones!
History is happening. I salute you. Tell everyone you know, go to the other side of the Capitol. That's where Trump's going to be.
Now, here's Jones the day after the riot on January 7th on his show explaining how it is that he came to know where Trump was supposedly going to be.
The White House told me 3 days before, we're going to have you lead the march. The Secret Service, before Trump finishes, 30 minutes before or so, will lead you to a point, take you out of the front row, and lead you to the place where they want you to start the march, and Trump will tell people, go, and I'm going to meet you at the Capitol.
Now, we have no clue what's actually in the trove of texts and emails that the January 6th committee is now very likely about to receive, but texts cannot plead the Fifth. There's lots to unpack here. Joining us now is Paul Butler, professor at Georgetown Law School, former federal prosecutor. Paul, thank you for being with us tonight. I want to start with a very basic legal question about the damages case against Alex Jones. Let's go back to the Sandy Hook story here. The first phase wrapped up today with this $4.1 million judgment against Jones for the Sandy Hook victim's parents. What happens next? There's a punitive stage to that. Is that a different trial or is that just a different decision by the jury?
So, Ali, the first phase of the trial was about compensatory damages or actual damages, how much money Jones has to pay back the families for the extreme harm he caused. Think of things like medical bills, moving expenses, security costs. This next phase is about punitive damages. That's about sending a strong message that Alex Jones probably won't understand, but to other people who are out there spreading conspiracy theories that they know are lies and that ruin the lives of innocent people, a huge punitive damage award might get their attention, might let them know actions have consequences. Intentional, malicious lies can cost you all your money. And if you lie under oath, you might even get locked up.
What's the line here? Because Alex Jones, for a very long time, said he was protected by the First Amendment in saying what he said. Lying's not against the law. What's the part that holds him responsible for this?
And if he had bothered to comply with the four other court proceedings and turn over documents, he might have had a chance to have his First Amendment claims litigated. But he didn't turn over documents. And now the Sandy Hook families have exposed Jones as a serial liar. As you mentioned, the defense attorney had the receipts to prove it in terms of all of those text messages. And Alex Jones was dumb enough to complain about the judge and jury at the same time that they were deciding the case.
Yeah.
He derisively called the jurors extremely blue collar and said they didn't know what planet that they were living on. The judge allowed the jury to hear that, and some of that money that he lied about having was earned from exploiting the families of dead children. After the jurors find punitive damages, Jones might actually be bankrupt.
What a story. Paul, thank you. As always, good to see you. Thank you for joining us. Paul Butler is a professor at Georgetown Law School and former federal prosecutor. We're just getting news that Senator Kyrsten Sinema has finally broken her silence, putting Democrats one major step closer to getting their big spending bill, which contains significant money to fight global warming through the Senate. That breaking news is next. All right, some breaking news I was just telling you about. The last holdout on the Senate Democrats' plan to pass a version of President Biden's agenda dealing with health care, climate, and taxes is now on board. Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona announced tonight she will support the legislation. There is a condition: the removal of the carried interest tax provision from the bill. That provision would close the loophole that allows private equity and hedge fund managers to pay a reduced tax rate on their share of profits from investments. In a statement, Senator Sinema said, quote, "We have agreed to remove the carried interest tax provision subject to the parliamentarian's review. I'll move forward." This follows speculations about whether she would support the bill and what appeared to be a lobbying effort from Senator Joe Manchin. The Senate chamber camera captured them talking today. Meanwhile, the Senate already started moving ahead in case the bill gets the all clear from the Senate parliamentarian. Earlier today, Senate leader Chuck Schumer announced the Senate will take tomorrow off, but will reconvene on Saturday and hold the first procedural vote to begin consideration of the bill. That motion to proceed only needs a simple majority. It cannot be filibustered and will jumpstart up to 20 hours of debate, equally divided between each party. Once the debate is over, they'll move on to a so-called votorama, a bunch of amendment votes that will conclude with a final vote to pass the package. And who knows when that would be, but maybe we'll be together for it. This is a big step in the right direction. Watch this space. And that does it for us tonight. We'll see you again tomorrow.